Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to a very special 4-year anniversary episode of My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and really, honestly, you'd have thought you would have got the format of this podcast after 4 years, but for any new listeners, this is the podcast where I ask people to tell me the 5 things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick 4 things that they cherish and 1 thing that they'd like to forget. Okay, we thought we'd try something a little different for this anniversary episode and revisit our very first episode with the wonderful Stephen Fry. Now, in the early days, we were a bit less confident than we are now, and therefore our editing was a bit more ruthless. So we thought we'd re-edit Stephen's episode with a more relaxed ear, a bit like one of Picasso's ears, but nothing as severe as Van Gogh's. This has resulted in a more relaxed conversation and plenty of unheard stories, jokes, and a few ums and ahs, which, let's face it, is interesting, I think, when you're listening to one of the most renowned speakers of our day, talking to Stephen Fry. Thanks to Stephen for letting us revisit this chat, which I hope, unlike Stephen and I, hasn't aged a bit. We hope you find it interesting to hear the difference. We certainly did. And if it goes down well, who knows? We may revisit some more of our episodes. Well, one day. In the meantime, happy birthday to us. And here is the incomparable Stephen Fry.
Well, it's pathetic, but you can do it on Zoom.
Why not? Let's pretend we're in the open air. I'm surprised I don't find you with a background of crowds of people all waving.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't it just? How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well, actually. Yes, I've had an extremely busy day. I just find it extraordinary. I've just done a voiceover down the line for Marie Curie.
Oh, very good.
It was very pleasing. My mother worked for Marie Curie when she retired as a district nurse.
Right.
It was quite touching to sort of remember the mornings as a teenage boy coming in and finding her sort of having a cup of tea and saying, "Are you all right, Mum?" And she would say, "Oh, yes, no, it was a good night. Yes, he went." It's an amazing thing.
It's extraordinary because that's, I don't mean that's all they do, but what I mean is that's their thing.
That's what they're aiming for.
It's for dying people, and it's an amazing thing to do. You have to be so strong, don't you?
Quite astonishing. I mean, I remember she was always very pleased when they went because that was what she was aiming towards. And she would say to me that she said to them at night when the family went to bed, okay, they've all gone to bed now. Now, I'm a professional and I've done this a lot of times and it's perfectly fine for you to go. And I promise you, if you go now, when they wake, you'll look lovely. And people relax and go, okay.
Phenomenal.
It sort of puts our lives into context, I think.
Somewhat. Somewhat. Got it. But you've been, you've got the family with you?
I've got my wife and my mother-in-law. Unfortunately, my children and grandchildren are sort of therefore, excluded from my life.
So you're connecting by Zoom and other things, presumably.
All the time, yes. But occasionally that's quite painful because you so want to see them physically.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is Elliot with you?
Yes, he is. Yeah, we're fine. We're fine and snug and safe here in Norfolk. I'm looking out across at the fields and everything, and it's all very charming. Where are you? Where do you live?
Tunbridge Wells.
Oh, my dear fellow. Yes. Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you?
Oh, marvellous.
I know.
And I'm sure the Tunbridge Wells waitress is as polite as it can possibly be.
And enormous distancing.
Yes.
But there always was.
Yes, quite.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, here we are with my podcast idea.
Absolutely.
Do you like this idea?
I think it's a fabulous idea.
It's been a joy because you tend to talk to people about things that, you know, why would they talk about this any other time? These are not things that they're publicising. This is not pushing anything.
That's right. Nothing to plug.
No, we're talking about something pleasant. You know, something interesting.
And how am I sounding to you?
Very good.
Is it all right? I'm using this chap here.
Yes, it's very good. Are you recording it at the same time?
Would you like me to?
Just in case, yes, in case you start to break up. And then you could just forward me the file. That would be marvellous.
Do we want to, we could count down to 10 together to sync it, if that helps.
Yes, for my son. I'll just give a big clap or something, then he'll know. Here it comes.
Good idea. We both did it at the same time. That's hilarious. But we're all right.
He'll work it out. Yes. He's a bit of a whiz. He did send me a contract a short while ago and said, so you just sign it. And I said, but I can't. How do I? And he said, you do it on the computer. Mm. I said, oh, for God's sake. And I see that you can manage to sign all your emails.
Yes. Yes.
I'm catching up slowly.
Right. that signature I use is ancient, but I was so proud of it because it was quite rare to have one anti-aliased, which you'll somehow understand, so that it's smooth and it has no jaggedness and everything, which is quite difficult to do. It's easy to do a line one, you know, a black signature, but this is a proper, you know, anyway, just shut up. Nobody.
Who knows? But anyway, before we start, I have a couple of people who say hello. Tim Bentinck.
Oh, bless him, yes.
Who says from very early days of computer use that you two were, they were just about the only people in the world who had email addresses, so you became connected.
Exactly right, dear Tim, yeah. I remember, God, there were some good stories he had. I remember when his father summoned him to say that Uncle Henry had died. And he said, well, I'm now the Earl of Portland, and that means you, Tim, are the Viscount Woodstock. I could let the thing slide. There's no money, but I get a seat in the House of Lords and you get the title. Well, and then you would get my title when I die. Well, what do you think? And Tim and Judy have a son, as you know, and he thought, well, it's not up to me to end this after centuries of whatever, you know, madness, because maybe my son will enjoy it. So he said, well, we'll do it. And what he said was, he had one credit card made with Viscount Woodstock written on it, which is actually better than the Earl of Portland as a title. I think Viscount Woodstock is very grand. He said to Judy, he said, let's go to Brighton where we had our honeymoon with the Grand Hotel. Let's just see if they treat us any differently. I'll call them up and book a suite. You know. So we can risk, you know, we were dirt poor drama students then, but now I'm a lord, and you're a lady. And so he called them up and he said, hello, yes, it's Lord Woodstock here. I wonder if I could have a suite. And they said, certainly, of course, we're very nice to welcome you. We're very happy to see you. So they were driving down, wondering how they'd be treated. Arrived, went into the reception and said, yes, name Woodstock, I believe you have a suite for me. And he went, sort of riffling through the cards. Oh, yes, Lloyd Woodstock. And he didn't have the heart to tell them that it was Lords. And that was it. Rather sweet.
Oh, bless him. And that was the only time he ever used it.
Yeah, basically. I mean, yeah.
Oh, Lord. Oh, there we are. Yeah, so very straightforward. I have a time capsule, and you are going to put five things into it, four of which you're fond of or remember happily, and one which you'd like to bury in the ground and be rid of.
That sounds very reasonable to me.
Yes, you may want five things to bury.
Well, you know, one could. There are lots of things you could choose to bury in there. But, you know, it's more fun to talk about things you love than things you hate, although it's easier to talk about things you hate, isn't it? I mean, so let me have a look, because I wrote them down.
Bless you.
Oh, here we are. So, five things. So we'll start with a very simple and obvious thing, I suppose, because it opens up into a whole world. And that is my grandfather's wind-up gramophone record. record player, gramophone, I mean. I discovered it in the attic and worked out how to use it with my brother. And there was a huge collection of these 78 records, these hard 78s. And for your listeners who are pretty young, probably might not have ever used a wind-up gramophone, but it's very simple. It's not even electric. You hand crank it, and you put on the record, and the needle it's a thick sort of needle that you can hold, and you shove it into this arm that has a membrane, or it connects all the way up to the famous, you know, big horn that comes out, and it makes a sound, and it's music. The reason it was so wonderful is the collection of records was full of things that I didn't know. It was a great mixture. There was classical music, things very obvious, things like the Blue Danube. And there was sort of jazz and swing. There was early Frank Sinatra singing Old Man River. And do you know there's a line of Robert Browning's, I can't remember what poem, I think it's in Pippa Passes, which is, can we ever hope to recapture that first fine, careless rapture? And you never can. You never can. No. And the fact is, I then, at the age of 11, listening to the Blue Danube or the Overture to the Barber of Seville by Rossini or whatever it might have been, or the Ride of the Valkyries, lying on my back, wriggling with an absolute transcendent joy at the music that was coming out with a hiss and a crackle and a jump. In a quality that we would now just regard as simply unacceptable. And you could pay hundreds of thousands for a system with giant speakers and the most amazing amplifiers and technology behind it. And I would never have that feeling that the music gives you. It's like first love. So it's that knowledge that is a sad knowledge that you can never go back and experience quite that intensity of joy that you have as a young adolescent. But you have to recognize that that is part of growing up, is that you know, you'll always enjoy the music, and I'll still get great, great joy from all kinds of music. But that absolute feeling of, it's hard to explain, but I don't need to explain, because I think it's common to all of us.
Yes.
I'm sure everybody can understand what I'm saying.
Did the player have a horn, or was it one of those box ones?
It was a box one. It was a sort of portable one. It was it was yay big. Yay being, I should think, about 18 inches by 18. And it looked like a little small valise, a small little suitcase. And you opened it up, and the arm came up. It was all beautiful. And, oh, goodness. I've since, I've bought one at a car boot sale or something. You know, and it is a charming thing. It's now just an object. But then it was everything to me, absolutely everything.
I had one for a while in my dining room, which was a cabinet. And the great thing about it was that they're always very loud, aren't they? They play incredibly loudly.
Yes.
But then you could open the doors of the cabinet, and it had a speaker down below. So it became incredibly loud. And on a number of occasions, I remember I had a copy of Judy Garland singing the Trolley Song.
Oh, how glorious. Yeah, that's it. That's so good.
It would bring me to tears because it was so, the sound was so of the time.
Yeah, yeah. It's, oh, goodness me. I mean, it's, music is, I mean, you know, anything you say about it has been said before and is, of course, true, but it's Hang on, I'm just pausing here because I accidentally pulled out the wrong thing. I meant to put, suddenly realized maybe
earphones so that your voice doesn't leak onto my mic.
Oh, that's a very good idea.
And I pulled out the wrong thing.
Are you on headsets now? Yeah, that's all right.
That's right. I'm on the headset now, and I just need to be less of an arse. Here we go.
We're now recording better, I think, because there's no chance of you leaking onto my track now.
Indeed. It's spoiling the music, as it were.
Yes. sorry, to return to that, yeah, I find music a profound part of my life, and I sometimes think it is more important to me than almost anything else there is, and yet I have almost zero talent at it. I can't sing. I fiddle on the piano so badly, I mean, compared to friends. I mean, my friend Hugh Laurie, your friend Hope, you know. We all know people who are very musical, and you can sing, at least. I know you can. You were a heap. Be for heaven's sake, it's like when I was 10 years old and I couldn't swim. I was a very late swimmer, and I remember at school you had to wear red swimming trunks if you were a non-swimmer, and all the swimmers wore blue swimming trunks. And I felt so, and I would watch people swimming, the other boys swimming, and it was like watching birds flying. I just thought, if I could do that, I would be the happiest person in the world. It would be like flying. And I always feel like that when I see people performing music. I think, how come I just can't do that? It's so frustrating. And yet the pleasure of listening to it and floating inside it is something I'll never tire of.
No. Chris Anderson said to me that he spoke to a repetiteur.
They're the people who play the piano for ballet dancers and
exactly. Office. And he watched this man work, and he said to him, oh, "I'd give anything to be able to play like you." And the man said to him, "Would you give 6 hours a day?"
That's a brilliant.
And you say, "Ah, right, yes, no, I see, of course." It's just a lot of hard work.
Yeah, that's true if you're a repetiteur, a pianist. It's true if you're Ronnie O'Sullivan. It's, you know, if you're you know, anything you admire. I think it was Lee Trevino, the golfer, wasn't it, who, when he drove off the tee and someone said to him, "God, you're lucky to have a swing like that." And he said, "Yeah, it's crazy. The more I practice, the luckier I get."
Yeah.
And no one wants to hear it. We all know that there is a secret to success. All these books that promise you how to be a success, and they all are absolute bullshit, of course, because the secret is you have to work incredibly hard at it.
Yes, and be really dedicated to it.
Yeah, and everyone wants to believe there's a shortcut, or that at least a shortcut even to learning how to work hard, because I think that's the weird thing. Some people can focus and concentrate and lose themselves in effort. And it almost seems easy, even though what we're talking about is effort. It's a peculiar paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, but, do you think that's one of the great benefits of a public school system? But if there are any, the question, do you think that that actually that thing of being in a room and being made to sit down and do prep every day.
In theory, it ought to be, but it wasn't for me. I was a disaster at public school and indeed was expelled regularly from different establishments. And I never worked when I was at school. I was gifted, and I suppose I still am, with a very facile and adept memory and ability to reproduce things that I hear without any effort, and a pastiching ability as well, so that I could always write essays without having to think very hard. But I never did at school particularly at all. My reports were awful, and I never worked. It was only after I was expelled, and then after I went to prison, and that I finally decided that I wanted to work. And that was the difference, wanting to do it. And yeah, I don't know why, something just clicked in my head. And I remember, for example, thinking, well, I have to go to university. And I always had set my heart on Cambridge. And And I'd been expelled from so many schools, and I was such a complete screw up that there was no chance of me getting into any other new school. But I did actually apply to a city college, who amazingly took me. But they didn't do Cambridge entrance, which you had to do in those days. So I studied on my own for that. And I remember reading through all the works of Shakespeare, all the plays and all the sonnets and the extended poems, and writing notes on them, which I still have, incredibly deep, complex notes. I read very slowly and very particularly all the way through every play until I knew them virtually backwards in terms of plot and character and everything about them, notes on the sources. And then I started to do this with other poems and other writers and with novels and things. It was mostly with literature because that's what I wanted to do at university. But it was extraordinary. I would get up at 6 in the morning and just sit and do that for hours and hours after. I mean, it was incredible. And my younger self, because I would say 18 when I was doing, or 19 when I was doing that, and 4 years earlier, I would have been incapable of doing it. So I had to go to prison in order to learn how to work. See,
it's not a recommended route, is it?
No. Only when lying prostrate, sobbing on the flags of the jailhouse with the shadows athwart my back and rats coming out of the straw and nibbling at my toes. Only then.
There are still people who say that it is the route, that actually all young people should have a spell inside or something to snap them into action.
that's
the idea, isn't it? Oh God! So, were you very close to your grandfather?
I was. He died when I was younger. He died when I was 10. So, he was a remarkable man. He was Jewish, Hungarian Jewish emigre from, and he came in the 1930s to Britain, which is why I'm still alive, because all his family unfortunately perished. Well, there were others who managed to get away to New York or Israel, but the vast majority perished in the Holocaust. But he was a fabulous, fabulous figure. He spoke 6 languages and was just everything was really fantastic. You know, he had this relish. He cooked and everything had to be the best, you know, so he had the most wonderful. I mean, he was a preposterous figure in some ways. He did well for himself, and he used to go shooting with the landed gentry in East Anglia, and he had brand new tweeds and brand new leather, and you know, and he didn't quite get that aristocrats don't do that. They have everything's falling to pieces, and you know. So I think he was rather a comic spectacle, but he didn't mind at all, and he was greatly loved. And
yes. My wife's family came over in the 30s. Her father's father came over in the 30s from White Russia, as it was called.
Yes.
And the same thing. So all their family, everybody who stayed or went to other parts of Europe, were killed, murdered. Terrible thing.
I did that program, Who Do You Think You Are? And of course, you know, it's if you have Jewish blood in you, then all roads will lead to Auschwitz.
Yes. Terrible
but it is extraordinary, and it mustn't be forgotten. One of the most extraordinary people I saw, funnily enough, this wasn't doing Who Do You Think You Are? It was doing, I did a program on Richard Wagner, the composer whose music I first heard on my grandfather's wind-up. And Jewish people tend to deprecate Wagner. They don't like, you know, my mother would hear me playing his music as I got to know it in my later teens, and say, must you play that awful man? And of course, he was an anti-Semite. He was an appalling, monstrous man. Hitler loved his music, which is also another way of tarnishing. Mind you, Hitler loved Johann Strauss and Beethoven too, and it doesn't stop us loving Beethoven. But and of course, Wagner was 50 years dead when Hitler came to power. But nonetheless, there's a problem with listening to Wagner, and I made a documentary about that very problem. And I went to see this remarkable woman called Anita Lasker-Wallfisch, who was a 15-year-old girl who had been at Auschwitz. And she was in the cappella, as they call it, the sort of orchestra, the little orchestra in the women's orchestra with Rosa Mahler as the conducting. And it was these Jewish girls, and she was a brilliant cellist, and that's what saved her life. And And she did at least tell me I said, you know, did you associate Wagner with the camps? She said, no, they never played Wagner. They played the marches, you know, and Strauss and things like that. And we didn't play Wagner. We didn't have the resources. We were just a small little band, a cappella, you know. She told me a story that I will never forget. That one day she was sitting on her bunk, as it were, you know, delousing a friend, and a friend was picking lice from her scalp, and the camp doctor came in and beckoned to her, curled a finger towards her. And she said, you may have heard his name. It was Josef Mengele.
Oh, my word.
And so my bowels turned to water, and I didn't know what to think. And I followed him. He pointed to my instrument, my cello, and I followed him with my cello into his office, and he pointed into the corner. And so I understood that I was to play. So I played. I said, do you remember what you played? She said, yeah, I played Träumerei by Schumann. I said, well, that's so beautiful. She said, yes. And I played. And what did he do? He was working, and I played more pieces, some Bach and other things. And then he dismissed me. And I said, did he thank you? He said, you poor child. He said, you still don't understand. Do you thank your telephone when you've used it? Do you thank your washing machine? Do you thank your computer printer? We were not human beings. That's how they could do what they did. We were not human beings. God. You think a 15-year-old girl is playing sublime music on a cello, and you're an educated man, a doctor, but you can still regard that human being as just a subhuman. Be quite happy about the fact that they're going to burn.
Extraordinary.
It's incredible. It's still a mystery, an imponderable mystery.
Yes, and it always is. That sort of ignorance is always a mystery. There's a man in Tunbridge Wells. When you come here next, you must go to Moss Bros and buy a suit from a man called Ralph Williams. He's called Ralph Williams because when he joined the paratroopers in 1942, having come over as a 14-year-old on the kinder transport,
wow,
they said you should. They told me I don't think that Finkelstein is a very good name to have in the paratroopers, so I changed it to Ralph Williams, and then I said to them, "They'll never guess I'm German now."
Oh, that's delicious. That's amazing. My grandfather was Neumann, and he changed it to Newman. He said, I took the final N, because, of course, Neumann has two N's at the end. It's N-E-U-M-A-N-N. He said, I took the final N and turned it upside down and put it next to the U, so it became Newman. All his friends who came, who were emigres like him, had very English names.
Yes.
That was considered the way to do it in those days.
In fact, the Fenton in my name is the English version of the Jewish name that my wife's family took. So I put the Fenton in.
Is that where it is? That's where you're Fenton Stevens.
And there are a lot of Fentons who are Jews.
That's wonderful. Yes. That's very pleasing.
Yes, it is. I'm glad to be associated in some way.
Yeah.
There we are. Well, how lovely. Well, we shall have that music playing hauntingly, well, loudly. Let's just play it loudly in the time capsule for you, and you can lift the lid anytime you like and hear it echoing through the halls of the time capsule for you. That's fabulous. So that's your first item. What's number two?
Well, number two is more disgraceful, but it's a reminder of it's a small and beautiful object, but it kind of sums up how pretentious and awful I was for so many years in my life. It's going to be a Dunhill lighter, cigarette lighter. they were extraordinary objects. They made a beautiful
thing.
Yeah, a sort of enamel with gold in the sort of piping or gold edging. I had it for years and years. And I was a smoker. I was a very keen smoker, a proud smoker, almost angrily proud about smoking and furious at anybody who thought it was a bad thing and couldn't bear all these, doctors and anti-smokers and all these laws that started to come in. You know, I grew up, you could smoke in cinemas and theatres and tube trains and buses. And, well, you know, you're the same generation as me. It was everywhere. And you look back now and you realise that smoking is a very small blip in human history. It cigarettes, I mean, well, even if you go back, obviously, you go back to pipes and Walter Raleigh, and there was a smoking of pipes amongst men only, and a few women, you know, the sort of Hogarth women in Gin Lane with the clay pipe and in Dickens and so on. And it wasn't really until the Duke of Wellington that cigarillos became fashionable, because the Peninsular War and the Portuguese and Spanish had got them from the New World, this habit of thin cigars, cigarillos. But they still weren't cigarettes. It was really only the end of the 19th century. Oscar Wilde's generation had cigarettes, and they made a great thing of it. Wilde was a scandal when he made a curtain speech after the great success of Lady Windermere's Fan. He appeared on stage when they cried for Arthur with a cigarette in his fingers. People thought, outrageous. Very, and actually, this idea that Victorians smoked all the time is not true. There's a marvelous book by E.F. Benson about his upbringing. His father was the Archbishop of Canterbury. That's E.F. Benson, who wrote Map and Lucia. Splendid figure. And he knew Tennyson and Gladstone and all these extraordinary high Victorians. And he said that this idea that everybody smoked is nonsense. Smoke was considered disgusting, but everybody did it. So they would have a room in which to do it and clothes in which to do it. And they would wear a cap so that the smell of the smoke didn't affect their hair. And that's why you had a smoking cap and a smoking jacket. So the women would depart at the end of dinner, and the men would go out of the dining room into the smoking room, put on the smoking jacket, smoke furiously, take it off, put on... It was quite extraordinary reading this, and I loved it. It was really fascinating. Mm. And then that was cigars, and then the cigarette, which was a sign of decadence, appeared. And it was really the First World War that changed it all. Suddenly, cigarettes were cheap and available, and machines made them, and everybody smoked. If you watch that Peter Jackson, you know, the wonderful restoration of all that First World War film, you know, they shall not grow old.
Yes, extraordinary.
And everybody has a cigarette in their mouth. Absolutely, yes. Everybody. So really, it was from about 1910, maybe, right up to through the 50s, 60s, 70s, which is only 60 or 70 years, really, people smoked. It's about the same length of time that people use the telephone. you know, people still do, but young people very rarely talk to each other on the phone. It's a legacy device. And, you know, if you grow up in the middle of it, it seems the most natural thing in the world to speak on the telephone. And for me, smoking. And fun enough, the two went together. I couldn't answer the phone without immediately sparking up.
So my wife's exactly the same. She was always the same. She really? Doesn't smoke anymore, but she was always the same. If the phone rang, she would run around the room trying to find her cigarettes before.
Yes. It's weird. It's a trigger. Strange kind of hardwired connection. And the other reason for the choosing the Dunhill lighter is it's so typical of me. You know, all my friends were much cooler. They all had Zippos or matches, you know, but or just throwaway Bics. But I had to have a bloody Dunhill lighter. Who did they think I was? And really, it started when I was on the run, when I was, you know, I'd stolen these credit cards and I'd go to stay in grand hotels and all these ridiculous clothes and stiff collars. And in those days, there were shops where you could buy really classy cigarettes. I mean, really extraordinary cigarettes. There was a shop called Sullivan Powell's in the Burlington Arcade off Piccadilly. Mm. And Sullivan Powell had their own, in beautiful maroon box with fabulous paper, they had their Private Stock was the name of their cigarette. Or you could have your own made up. Morlands was another, which James Bond had Morlands with two gold rings around, which were made up for him. And there was another one on the Haymarket called Freiburg and Trier, who was, made cigarettes. And these were really extraordinary. And there were things like Sobrani cocktail.
Yes. The black colored, ones for the gold.
Colored, that's right. And they were a mixture of Turkish and Virginian tobacco. And I would have cigarette cases as well. And you'd have Turkish on the left and Virginia on the right. And you're off them. So Turkish on the left, Virginia on the right. And they go, oh, he is grand, isn't he? And there were certain types of cigarette that were oval. Passing Clouds was a make of cigarette. It was oval. And the reason it was oval was then you could have the really slim cigarette case. The one that was slightly curved so that it would fit into your inside pocket and it wouldn't ruin the cut and line of your jacket. Mm. And you could fit in all the cigarettes. So there was a huge amount of art and design went into smoking. Both in the Dunhill lighters and these fabulous deco Lucite objects, cigarette cases and, you know, the beautiful boxes and so on. You know.
Was your lighter, was it machine tooled?
Yes.
Yes.
It was stunning.
You click it on the side.
That's right. Beautiful. Mm. Just brush it with your thumb and it would just give this lovely noise as the flint engaged.
Yes.
Oh, a heavenly thing.
If only we could find another use for them.
If only. Yeah. And I've still got it somewhere. And, you know, would need servicing.
Like we all do.
Yeah, I gave up when I was 50. My 50th year coincided with the banning of smoking in public places in pubs and restaurants and everything. So it just seemed natural and it was pointless fighting it. And I do feel all the better for having given it up and I hate the smell of it and I can't believe I ever did it. And it was another me. And that's the mystery of life, Mike, isn't it? The paradox of you know, Theseus' ship. Do you know the Theseus, the great Greek hero.
I'm going to bow to your knowledge of...
No, but he slew the Minotaur. This is a post-mythic paradox, the Theseus' ship. He slew the Minotaur and supposedly, you know, and he became the founder king of Athens. And he ruled Athens and divided up Attica, the kingdom in which Athens is, into its demes, its various sort of areas, and all that. Anyway, the point is that at Piraeus or whatever, the harbour of Athens, his ship was moored. And it was people, after he died, it was people come and see it. This is Theseus' ship. And it lasted hundreds of years, thousands of years. It lasted into the classical period, into the period of Plato and Aristotle and the great philosophers and the period of Themistocles, you know, and all of these figures. And yet every part of it had been replaced because this plank had got rotten, a new plank got in, and this bit of rigging had fallen, perished, and new rigging. And so there was not one part of it that was the original ship, but it was the ship. And our bodies are the same.
Yes.
Our bodies, and therefore our minds, because our brains, every single atom of us is different. To the atoms of 15 years ago, or you know, I can't remember the exact length of time, but you know, it's a known truth. It's hardly needs to be repeated. We're aware of it. We know it. We slough every part of us in the way that a snake sloughs its skin. And so, how can we say, are we like Theseus' ship, the same person? That person who smoked and that person who wriggled around with joy listening to that music, he's long dead. Every part of him, every single cell has been replaced.
How do you remember him? So that's the
extraordinary thing. The memory has stayed. That's right. The memories and the experiences have passed through into the new cells and neurons that have. And that's a great mystery. And a rather wonderful one. Mm-hmm. So I will look fondly in my Fenton Stevens pouch of four lovely objects. I will look fondly at the lighter because it will remind me of a dead me and a me that would have died even earlier if I'd carried on smoking. Probably.
It's still a beautiful object in itself, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't they now refer to his ship as, isn't it now Trigger's Broom, as they say?
Have you heard that? Same thing. Yes, that's right. Or the Philosopher's Axe. And actually, P.G. Woodhouse's typewriter. Oh, P.G. Really? Woodhouse bought a Royal typewriter in his in the early part of the 20th century. And he wrote on it right until his death in the 70s. But every part of it, the platen and the roller and the keys and the chassis, were all replaced over. So a similar thing. Yes. And that brings me on to my next object.
Carry on, enough. Right, I hope you're enjoying either rehearing this reimagined episode or enjoying it for the first time. Unfortunately, we have to take a short break for some ads. We'll be back, well, I was going to say shortly, but that seems absurd in an episode with the gigantic Stephen Fry, so we'll be back tallly.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back. Let's find out what else the lovely Stephen Fry chose to put in his time capsule.
It's a mint green, so beautiful, mint green Hermes Ambassador typewriter, a manual typewriter. I wish I could show you. I'll upload you a picture. You can include it somewhere if you like. They're beautiful objects. And I loved typing. I taught myself to type when I was in my teens again. And I used to amaze people with the speed with which I could type. Now, of course, no one being the least bit impressed because I had no idea it would become this, common skill that everybody has. Because if you go back to the 1970s and 80s and you ask people to type, unless they were a secretary, they would go plonk, plonk, plonk with, their index fingers up and down. And I was always like that, because I just loved it. I there was something about seeing the words appear on the paper with the bang, bang, bang of the typewriter that gave me enormous pleasure. So when I got to university, I had it with me, and I would type up my essays, which, again, people listening, students listening, would go, what? You just email them? What are you talking about? You email them to your tutor. What do you... Huh? And, originally what you'd do, as most people would do, would be they'd write an essay with a pen or a biro on paper, and they would leave it at their tutors or their lecturers or whatever they were called, the person they were writing the essay for. They would leave them in their pigeonhole, because that's how communication was done, things called pigeonholes. So, that was the same at school and at universities. In various common areas of an institution, there would be these wooden little slots that were known as pigeonholes that had usually dymoed a plastic name stuck above it. So Dr. Lancaster, it would say, or Dr. Holloway or whatever. And you would shove your essay into his pigeonhole, and he would come clear his pigeonhole. Or if he was a seniorish, a porter would do it for him and drop it off at his rooms. Or occasionally you could put them in his rooms if it was that sort of an institution, a college, say, where he lived in, except it was all he in my case. Well, that's the other. Yeah, we allowed women into our college after 800 years in my last year, which was a huge move forward. It was a great thing, but just weird to think that it hadn't happened before. But anyway, so that's how essays were given, when you were working.
And you typed them all out afterwards.
So I would write them in longhand and then type them up. And I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed the change from handwriting to the sort of somehow official looking as typescript that just made me feel that this was somehow meant to be. And occasionally I'd get so annoyed because I'd have to correct something when I read it through again. And I would do it with a pen, or I think, well, should I retype that whole page? No, that's just too anal. And I then, in my last year at university, I started collaborating with Hugh Laurie on writing comedy. Emma Thompson, with whom I'd done plays and things, he'd said he wanted to meet me. He had met me briefly at Edinburgh the year before when I'd written a play. But he had inherited this club called the Footlights Club, which is a comedy club at Cambridge. And he was the president of it. And he wanted people to write sketches, comedy with. And that was what it was, a review thing, review, R-E-V-U-E. Mm. Sort of cabaret style comedy. And so Emma took me around to his rooms and we started writing together. And then I began to collate different sketches for reviews and things. And I would always type them up. And I've still got some. I've got one framed that I wrote with Emma in mind, and Emma and I did, and then did on television, which I never would have guessed while I was writing it. But that typewriter saw me from my lowest ebb of starting to get myself together, as I spoke about, when I had left prison and decided that I wanted to work. Mm. And all the way through university, right up until the early 80s, when we'll come to that. It's the next object, actually.
Okay. Strangely, I think I also have a file somewhere of Footlights sketches typed up, but sadly not yours.
Oh!
My file was Martin Bergman's.
Oh yes, he was just before me.
Yes. And he left it in the dressing room at the end of Edinburgh, and I thought, oh, that's all there. Well,
there's a club room. There was a Footlights club room that we used to practice in, and on the walls were all the photographs of previous Footlighters: John Cleese and Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller and all these, Clive James and Douglas Adams and all these extraordinary heroic figures that I was just couldn't believe, that we would ever be worthy of touching the hem of their garments, as it were. Mm. But I discovered a little book that was the Footlights May Week Review title suggestion book, because you're always trying to think of a title. And I saw one, and I since checked with Eric Idle, and it was he who had done it when he was an undergraduate there. It was the best title for a show. Of course, they didn't do it. It was Captain Fellatio Hornblower. That should have been the title of the show.
That would have dragged him in on tour, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. But it's clever of me, not clever, but fortuitous of me to have mentioned Douglas Adams, actually, because he did become a friend. And he and I both, on the same day, bought in January 1984, January the 25th, 1984, the first ever in Europe Apple Macintosh computers. They arrived.
Wow.
And to most people, there was a kind of, so what? That's not really a computer. It's a toy. It's got a graphic user interface. It was advertised with hello written on the screen in handwriting. Yes. Now, all computers up until then, without an exception, that is sort of proves the rule, because it was an Apple computer called the Lisa. But all computers until then were black screens with a kind of glowing neon writing. Mm-hmm. And there was no mouse, there were no menus. You just typed commands, and you got lists back of what was on your files and directories and so on. And here was this whole new way of doing it, using an image or using an analog of a desktop with a little waste paper bin and folders, like folders you would have in an office, and you could pull and push piece documents around. And it was utterly extraordinary, and people thought that it was a gimmick, but Douglas and I were convinced it was the future, and that it was exciting, and that it was the way forward. And we became thrilled with this. So my first Mac, which was a 64K memory, RAM memory, 64K. I mean, you couldn't, I mean, just unbelievable. My saying hello is more than 64K now, yes, that you've just heard. I mean, that, it's just, yes, preposterous how little it was. And yet you could do so much with that because it forced programs to be unbelievably accurate and not to waste any single vital bit of memory. And by the end of the year, there was a 128 version. It had doubled in RAM. And then slowly, you know, out came color ones. And then many, many years later, Microsoft thought, oh, this does seem to be the future. And they produced something they called Windows, which was a pretty grotesque knockoff, but that's fine.
They still seem to suffer slightly from the command alt delete thing, the thing of having to use your keyboard for everything.
Yes, though, of course, people who use them like it very much, and because they're used to it, and I think that's partly, you know. And nowadays, the whole battle is over as to, mm-hmm, you know, everything's a graphical user interface, everything's Windows and pull down menus. WIMPs, it used to be called. Windows, icon, mice, and pull down menus with WIMPs, WIMPs. And it's a marvelous thing. And of course, in 2010, sadly, long after Douglas died, you know, he died of a heart attack, very young, 49 years old. And the iPad that came out in 2010 was so like, really, Douglas's book, his Hitchhiker's, yes, Guide to the Galaxy. It was a, yes, simple, beautiful thing that could contain the world or the universe or the galaxy.
Absolutely, to have foreseen the smartphone, really. That's what, yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is. I mean,
I missed Douglas so much. He missed so many of these technological explosions, and I miss the take he would have had on them. He would have had an insight and a way of explaining them and a way of deflecting the worst aspects of them, because there have been terrible aspects, of course. But, you know, he died in 2001, I think it was.
Good Lord, is it that long ago?
Yeah, and since, you know, it was another 6-7 years before social media began slowly to take off, Twitter and Facebook and so on. And the iPhone itself didn't come out till 2007, and then the iPad in 2010.
Yes.
And because of my passion for these doodads and these toys, it's a perfect example of being careful what you wish for, because, you know, I really did think they would change the world, and they did, but they didn't change it necessarily as happily as I had imagined they would. I was very naive in how I thought, particularly the networking when that came in the late 80s and the early 93, 94, Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web, and I really thought this was it, you know, the boundaries between people would melt away, differences and misunderstandings would dissolve, that the online presence of free museums, art galleries, libraries, cinemas, dance halls, meeting places, assembly rooms, people with tastes and passions and hobbies that before had relied on grubbly, ronioed fanzines could reach out and be in touch with each other.
But instead, it seems to have, to an extent, reinforced bigotry, which is...
It absolutely reinforced all the worst aspects. It's a terrible shock that this should have been the outcome, but it's probably foolish of me not to have foreseen it. I probably should have understood this was how the world was going to be, but it is depressing, to say the least.
I know. So you slightly want to go back to... back to the Remington, as it were.
Yes, almost. Of course, you can never do that. You can never put the genies back in the genies of technology back in their bottles. You can never uninvent. I mean, you know, certainly, I still believe human beings are good and decent and kind. One of my great literary heroes, P.G. Woodhouse, when he lived in London, in Norfolk Street, in Mayfair, he would write letters. He had a big correspondence. He wrote every single day and was on his typewriter, on his royal typewriter. Indeed, he wrote me a letter when I was 14. I wrote to him. Yeah, and he wrote, I've still got it, and the signed photograph.
Of course. Yeah.
But he in London, he said that he always would fold up the letter, put it in an envelope, stamp it, and throw it out the window. Because he reasoned that the average person seeing a stamped addressed envelope lying on the pavement would pick it up and put it in the postbox. And he claimed he never had a letter go missing.
That's a beautiful test of humanity, I think.
Isn't it just?
I left a parcel in a trolley at the supermarket. I put the trolley back at the supermarket and left a parcel that needed to be posted in the child carrying part of it. And yeah. Then when I realized when I got home, I was tempted to apply that theory to think, well, somebody's bound. They're not just going to leave it there, are they? They'll post it for me.
Yeah.
But I didn't have his faith, I'm afraid. I went back and got it.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. Well, there you are. Yeah, I mean, people are fundamentally good, but they're also scared and anxious, and especially as we're speaking at the moment, full of dread and doubt and worry and so on.
Yes.
We won't go
into maybe hope, maybe sort of, maybe this will be a
way of emerge, blinking into the sunlight. We'll make a compact to build a better world. Well,
I mean, that's been said before, I know, and it's a thing that everybody hopes for, but you do think that people may learn some lessons from it,
you know, yeah,
which would be nice.
At the very least, yeah, including one hopes that if it is true about the zoonotic creation of this human virus from bats and pangolins, if that is truly the case, we must insist that China no longer does what it does with animal markets. It's
yes,
it's dangerous as well as being obscene.
Obscene, yes.
It's dangerous too.
Yes. Yes. Well, we should move on. The typewriter is there for you to tap away anytime you like.
So we're going now to what I'm going to put into the to be thrown away into
right.
garbage pail, because that was four objects, and then my fifth object. And if I say, you'll immediately think, what? I'm going to say heaven. Now, but by that, I don't mean the supposed divine place with the angels and the harps and the fluffy clouds. I mean the gay disco of the 1980s. But it stands for all gay discos, and it stands for all discos, and it stands for dance. Because I've said this before, and if people have heard it, then forgive me for repeating it, but I abominate and loathe and fear and dread and hate dance more than almost anything in the world. I cannot bear it. And I chose heaven because when I left university in 1981, it was the same year that something arrived. I arrived in London at the same year as the human immune virus, the HIV, although it wasn't known at the time, AIDS. Of course, indeed, in those days, it wasn't even called AIDS. In 1981, there was a rumor amongst my gay friends of this thing, a bathhouse flu at first. And no, it's worse than flu. It's like a cancer. No, it's worse than that. And then someone told me it was called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency.
Good Lord.
And then the phrase AIDS stuck, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. And I started to hear about friends getting ill and death sentence. But around that was sort of more 82, 83, 84, and then further on. It was just rumors in 81. But I arrived in 81 as a gay person, quite happily out. And indeed, I had a partner, my lover from university, and we shared a house a flat in Chelsea together. And he liked to go to heaven, and he would grab me and take him to go. And I just... the moment we went in, the noise, the spectacle of people leaping up and down, and I just wanted to be so far away from it. There was nothing about it. It was just agony to me. I can't tell, even thinking about it, I'm coming up in hives. I can't dance. I don't know how to. I don't know what that dancing means. It was as if I missed a whole load of lessons that everyone else had about. What do you do? Which part of your body do you move? Do you swing your hips? Do your feet go up and down? Do they leave the ground? I mean, I would look at people doing it and think they're all different and it's all horrible. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't. And the music, I mean, it's just all the music. And I can understand why it gets into people's brains and sort of if they're drunk enough or you know, this was before the rave culture, so MDMA wasn't a known thing, but there was cocaine, and there was poppers in the gay world were huge, you know, for all kinds of reasons which we won't go into, but I'd drink a bit, but I still didn't want to dance. I just wanted to talk to people. And the other thing was, of course, I was never very cute. So you go into these places and immediately anybody new going into a place like that, the eyes turn and the eyes rake up and down and then turn away. And you think, I've been rejected. Oh, but I've come in. Everybody hates me. Nobody wants to speak to me. And the fact is, if I look back, I was probably wearing a Harris tweed jacket. They probably thought, who is this? Is he an off-duty policeman? I don't know. But anyway, I just loathe that world. It was called the scene in those days, the gay scene.
Do you think it's the curse of being tall, Stephen?
I don't know. I mean, all my life, I've never been sure whether I wanted to join in or whether I wanted to stand apart from the human race. You know what I mean? And I think this is a common thing. One is torn between wanting to be apart from and an equal and opposite pull of being a part of. And I remember that at school. I would watch people playing rugby or cricket or joining in, you know, music and sharing records and things and thinking, I'm different. I don't like that sport. I don't like that. I have my poetry. I have this. I'm an individual. I'm myself and I can't bear. And then another part of me yearned to belong, to be part of the tribe. And
that's a very defensive thing as a teenager, though, that, isn't it?
It's
to say I don't need people and I'm going to keep myself. Yeah. So I became a bird watcher because that was a solitary habit. I mean, it meant that I could go out on my own and I didn't want other people there because they were noisy.
I could just
sit for hours and hours and hours on my own.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's so true. And I think I was very the same and always have been, and I suppose always will be. But when it comes to dancing, and to this day, I don't know the last time I've ever been into anything that can call itself a disco, but you go to weddings and people insist on having a wooden floor of people dancing. And apart from anything else, even seeing other people dance makes me actually almost cry with embarrassment. I'm genuinely embarrassed at the sight of them doing it, and I just want to cover my mouth and look away. And as for these television things, they have these dance things on ice and in all kinds of different... I mean, I've never seen more than 30 seconds because it's like an electric shock of pain and distress. And yet, weirdly, I can watch Fred Astaire till the cows come out.
You know, who couldn't?
Sure. Absolutely, but it's not the same. He's doing is art, and it's beautiful. And I'm friends with Matthew Bourne, the choreographer, and I go and see his wonderful ballets sometimes, and they are fantastic. He did the Red Shoes this year. It's just
I'd sort of agree with you about discos and that sort of thing. They generally are full of people who can't dance, so that's perfectly understandable that you would look at it in horror. But I have a memory of a wedding disco, which of course usually are the worst, but it's a very fond memory that my mother sat almost sort of cupping her ears the whole way through. I think it's too loud and it's all young people's music. I don't like it at all. And then they started playing the hit from a few years ago, Get Lucky, or I think it's called Up All Night to Get Lucky. Anyway, they started playing that song, and suddenly in the middle of this dance floor, my mother came in, basically doing the Lambeth walk, just off. And she had everybody stopped and looked, and she just strutted her way up and down the dance floor. And it had hit her somehow. That piece of music actually just affected her as if it was a proper song.
Yeah. And of course, I know that it gives enormous pleasure and that it is about joining in and that I've never been able to join in and let go. All my life, even when I was a bit of a party animal, not at that sort of dancing party, but party animal is, of course, a euphemism for someone who drank too much and put things up his nose. even then, people would say to me, I'd really like to see you drunk one day, Stephen. You know, I just want to see you lose it. And I think, why do people insist on saying that? I think it's because they always mistrusted my apparent control, the fact that I never did seem to get drunk and that I was always slightly distant. I can remember drunk people, to this day, drunk people say to me, I want to get to the bottom of you, Stephen. There's, you know, you're always hiding, you're masked, you know, there's a mask, isn't there? And I think, well, I don't know, is there? Probably.
Well, it's strange enough, I would say the opposite. I really think you've always been. I've always found you incredibly open.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, and generous in it. You know, you must. You, Well, for example, this sort of thing. The calls on your time must be endless. And yes. and so it is, it's a very difficult thing to cope with. People who've not had sort of your level of fame don't understand the pressures that come with it. And so to be as generous with it as you are, I think, is an extraordinary thing. You should be very proud of it.
Well, bless you. And it's there's so much to be incredibly grateful for, though. I mean, if my 15-year-old self or even my student self could possibly have a sense of the doors that have been opened to me and the opportunities that I've had and the experiences that I've enjoyed. And I'd curl up and explode, I think. I would not believe how fortunate I've been. And, on the more serious note that is hardly original, but that everyone's thinking of at the moment, our generation has been lucky in that way too.
Yes.
I mean, almost every decade of mine has been the decade to be. You know, when I was a boy, it was the period of exciting, even things like breakfast cereals. Sugar Puffs was invented the year I was born, and there was Ricicles and Tony and his Frosties and that whole sort of child advertising thing, because we were the generation that they could advertise to. And then when we were teenagers, there was rock and roll and pop and the Top of the Pops, and we our consuming generation was the generation again. And then in our 20s and 30s, in our 30s, there was even a TV show called 30-something, which was about how cool it was to be in your 30s. And every decade, and life's peach, we have sucked the juice out of it like no other generation. And we are handing this dried-out husk to the generation below who can't barely expect to get a house or a future. Yeah. And now, after this coronavirus, an even bleaker landscape confronts them. And they have ransomed our lives, our elderly lives, because of this disease. And the price has been phenomenal.
I've heard it argued that that in fact it's a price too high to pay. Then
yes,
we should be paying back
by allowing ourselves to go, and we'd also be releasing lots of housing stock. Mm-hmm. I suppose. I mean, yes, it's very hard to say. Doctors, of course, by Hippocratic oath, will always do everything they can to rescue a life, whether they're 105 or 25.
Yes.
That's their job. And I don't know how you could tell a doctor to let someone die. They just wouldn't be able to. It's not in their code in any way. But it certainly, as a thought experiment, it's a very powerful thing to say that, and of course, as in all these issues, science fiction writers and others have got there first. Do you remember a film called Zardoz with Sean Connery?
I do. Of
early 70s.
Sean Connery looking very strange.
That's right. John Alderton is in it, which he's not in many movies, John Alderton. But essentially, the elderly are, or if on your 50th birthday, you shuffled in along to die and you're given a pill. I think it's a rather nice pill. So, I mean, let's say now 70 is the new 50. I'm a few years away from that, but not that many, I suppose. It'll give you a week with some really good quality heroin.
I think you're going to say claret.
and then an overdose on the last day.
Yes.
Well,
fair enough. The other film that I remember as a teenager that actually made me think about these things for the first time was Soylent Green.
Yes. I do remember that one very well. Superb. Don't give away the ending.
No, I won't give
it away. A bit like Planet of the Apes, you mustn't give away the ending.
That was, for me, the moment that I fell in love with classical music. It's strange, isn't it? Because actually the euthanasia scene where they show, and they played the Pastoral Symphony.
Yes, they do, don't they? And of course, famously in 2001, the use of classical music, as always, with Kubrick is superb, isn't it? Yeah, there was a period of these movies. There was, Soylent Green, Zardoz, and of course, Logan's Run was another.
Yes.
So that was Jenny Agutter and Michael York.
Planet of the Apes. And those.
And Planet of the Apes. And that's the Omega Man with Charlton Heston. Was another.
Yes.
Which they remade with Will Smith as something else.
Do we meander? We meander
yes,
off.
Yes, we do. Sorry, everybody. But anyway, it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
It's been an absolute joy. It's very, very sweet of you to do this, and it's lovely to see you, as always. I have a very fond memory of you, which you won't remember at all, but I'm going to remind you of it.
Go on.
We once were chatting in Berwick Street, and a sweet old lady came up to you and said, "Oh, hello, I love your Jeeves and Wooster." And you said, "Oh, how lovely. I do another programme with Hugh. It's called A Bit of Fry and Laurie. Perhaps you'd like to watch that." And she said, "Oh, no, I don't think so." And you said, "Well, give it a go. And I'll tell you what, this is my number. Call me and let me know what you think." And you gave her a mobile phone number.
I remember. That's, oh, goodness me. How clever.
I wonder if she ever rang you or if she ever watched it. But I was so taken aback by the sort of generous nature of it. So there you are. So next time you think people think you're a bit standoffish, you know.
Well, you know, I can sometimes be caught in a terrible mood, I suppose.
Can't we all?
Someone listening will say, "No, I remember trying to speak to him in the street once and he was extremely churlish."
Stephen, lovely to see you. Thank you so much for doing
you.
This.
A delight. All the best.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Stephen Fry. Thanks for listening, or indeed for listening again. I hope this new relaxed episode entertained, and that my producer and son John and I have learnt our lesson. I think we have. If you had a good time, do let us know via social media or by emailing mytimecapsulepodcast@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast. And of course, there are ways of letting others know you enjoy My Time Capsule, such as rating it or reviewing the podcast. The theme tune by Pass the Peas Music can be found on Spotify, or you can help us out by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details in the description of this pod, where for a small fee you get no ads and a weekly bonus podcast, which is, quite frankly, a pile of old tosh. But it seems the sort of old tosh that some people enjoy. You might. Check it out. You can cancel at any time. Just saying, this was a cast-off production, along with the well over 400 episodes available any time for you to listen to. That's if you include all the Christmas episodes, of course, and the special episodes. The actual 400th episode of the actual podcast is coming up soon, so if you have anyone you'd particularly like to hear as our special guest, then do let us and them know, particularly if you're their agent. We'll be back very soon, though, so I'll leave you with the joke that Stephen used to tell to the studio audience at recordings of A Bit of Fry and Laurie. Knock, knock. That's where you say, "Who's there?" Well done. "Kylie." You say, "Kylie who?" Very good. And I say, "That's showbiz." Bye. Happy birthday to us. Happy birthday to us. Happy birthday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.